Video essays on youtube.com/okbeast are now weekly. Subscribe and check out the channel every Friday for a new video. To help us out, we brought on our newest member of OK Beast, Moises Taveras. If you don't know him, don't worry, you will, and you will love him. He's a very soft boy. Rate us on iTunes. Every rating helps, and every time you rate, a young boy receives a copy of Donkey Kong 64 in the mail. The OK Beast podcast is a weekly gaming and nerd culture-centric show. This is where we get together and talk about the biggest topics in games and culture. If you like the show, subscribe to us on your streaming service of choice, visit okbeast.com, and follow at okbeastnow on Twitter and Instagram. Yo, what's up? Welcome to the OK Beast podcast, episode 55. I'm one of your hosts, Blessing Adeoye. Joining me this week is a very special guest, Youssef Magid from Ubisoft. How are you doing today, Youssef?
I'm good, Blessing. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. Thanks for joining me.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me on, man. I really appreciate it. This is actually my very first podcast.
Oh, nice. Well, welcome. I hope that it's a good one. If it sucks, then no worries, because I'm sure you have other podcasts you're going to go on in the near future, if I remember correctly. And so,
quite possibly, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So, like, if for some reason I don't steer you right in this one, then you got other ones to look forward to, so no worries. But, I mean, to start off, who are you? What do you do?
Yeah, so that who are you question is it's kind of difficult to answer, just because sometimes I feel like it can just boil down to, like, what have you done kind of thing. So my name's Youssef. I'm 26. I'm an Egyptian Muslim American. First person in my family that was born in the U.S. I am obviously a gamer. I've been gaming since, you know, I could walk. Essentially, never thought it would ever be a career for me, never thought I'd be doing that. And I now work in PR at Ubisoft. I'm a PR assistant there. And I guess we'll get more into the weeds a little bit, but that's sort of the short elevator pitch of who I am.
Nice, man. And I think your biggest claim to fame is that you're Nick Scarpino's personal trainer.
That's true. I am Nick Scarpino's personal trainer. Jack in 2017.
It's hilarious because I asked for questions, and a good 80% of the questions we got was about you and your physical stature. Do you get that a lot? Do you get people talking about how jacked you are?
I mean, more so probably in the last year than I probably have in my entire life. mostly just because I've always been an athlete my entire life. I've always, since I was 14, I've always sort of been lifting weights, things like that. When I was playing football, I did track and field in college. I was a thrower. And so I've always kind of been around really big guys, and most of my friends are really big, thick guys. That's the word we like to use kind of to describe ourselves.
Yeah.
So I'm actually, out of my two closest friends, I'm the smallest one. I'm the weakest one. So I'm not used to that. And then kind of coming into, this last year really. To be fair, ever since I sort of graduated undergrad, just kind of being the bigger dude in the room a lot of times, or the stronger dude. I'm actually a certified personal trainer also. I was doing that for a little while. It's just always kind of been a part of my life, fitness, working out,
Dude, that's awesome.
Thank you.
It's crazy because, I met you very, too briefly at Kinda Funny Live. Was it 3?
Dang. Yeah.
That's crazy that it's 3. But I met you at KFL 3. You introduced yourself, and I was like, wait, you're Youssef? And I don't know why, for some reason, I was expecting, I don't know what I was expecting, to be honest. I was like, dang, this dude's jacked. Whatever.
Yeah,
I don't think I said that.
I remember,
I was like, dang, dude.
I remember you saying, you're taller than I expected you to be.
Yeah. And I was like, man, that's crazy. But I've known you from Twitter, I feel for a while. Because I can't remember if I followed you first or you followed me. But I remember seeing you pop up on Twitter a bunch. Replying to tweets and stuff. And I think... I know for a fact I'd followed you before I even realized that you worked for Ubisoft, or you're even in
homies with like Sean and like and those guys, and because you're in San Francisco, and yeah. so like you hang out with like Sean and Barrett and all those guys. I didn't realize that till like probably like a few months ago, and I've been, and I'd see you on Twitter all the time, and I'd be like, oh yeah, that's Yusef. He's like awesome because he like interacts with people.
It's same thing for mine. Like I don't know when or where it started, but yeah, I definitely started noticing you on Twitter. It's mutual friends or people we follow, you know, liking your tweets, retweeting them. And yeah, like personally too, like it was, like you're not afraid to speak your mind, which I really appreciate, whether it's, you know. And I think Sean Fitz like had like the greatest summary. He was like, I either completely agree with your tweets or completely disagree with your tweets. Like there's no in between, which I really appreciate actually.
Thanks.
Cause you know, you got to come in there with a hot take sometimes.
I've been trying to slow down recently because I feel like my takes have been like too hot. And I don't mean that in the sense that as like they're great, cause they're not, but in the sense that like, I'm becoming like too controversial and I don't want to like turn people away because like, The more I say that Donkey Kong 64 is an amazing game, the more people will not take me seriously. Even though I truly believe that Donkey Kong 64 is like one of the best games.
There's nothing wrong with that. So the game, like my favorite game of all time, like is most people never even played it or like, So like I completely appreciate the, you know, the fire takes. But yeah, I at the same time I get that, you know. You don't want to always be so polarizing.
Yeah. And like I've even felt bad about it sometimes because I remember I think it was during E3, like after the Ubisoft conference, I was like, wait, people really love that conference? And a lot of people were like, oh yeah, you crazy, all that stuff. And like people kept I got so many replies that day of like people being like, oh dude, that conference is amazing. They had this, they had that. And I felt bad because I saw you like liking all the replies to me, and I was like, oh dang. I hope I didn't like hurt Yusef or whatever, because I legitimately was like, oh man, I forget who follows me sometimes, and I don't want to I assume you're fine. I assume you didn't care about it, but I was like, oh man.
No, it's all good. I mean, obviously, speak your mind, speak the truth. So yeah, I mean, it's it was E3 was awesome. It was so fun to get to go to, get to see, get to watch the conference.
You were at E3.
Yeah, it was. It was my first E3.
How was that?
It was amazing. Like, it's, you know, obviously growing up, I'm guessing similar, you know, to how you grew up, just like loving games. Like, E3 is a dream. You know, it's like, it's that dream come true to get to go. It's a very different experience going on the PR side versus like what I think most people imagine of like going as like a media journalist, something like that, where like, I came back and my friends were like, oh my God, how many games did you play? And I'm like, I played one and it was our game, like all, you know, the entire week. So it's definitely not like going and walking the show floor all the time, but actually I think it was a bit better because I got a bit of the more insider perspective. And like, to me, hands down, the thing I'm always going to remember and the thing that was by far my favorite part is the human side of it. And like, whether that was getting to meet people that I had been following on Twitter, or, you know, we had Twitter exchanges with, or developers I was a fan of, or, you know, just getting in, like, for example, is Ashraf Ismail, the creative director on Assassin's Creed Origins. He was also the creative director on Assassin's Creed Black Flag. And he obviously, like, Black Flag is one of my favorite games ever. I'm super excited for Assassin's Creed Origins. And he's also a Middle Eastern man. Like, he's like, I'm Egyptian, he's Iraqi. And I remember meeting him, and he's the nicest, sweetest, humblest dude in the world. And just introducing myself and saying, like, thank you so much for making this game. Like, I legitimately never thought in my entire life I'd get to play a game as an Egyptian character. And the fact that he's doing it is literally a dream come true. And it was like, and he was totally gracious, like you could tell it meant the world to him, and he understood how much it meant to me. And also just seeing the mutual love and admiration in the industry in general, like I think it's easy from an outsider perspective to be like, oh, you know, so-and-so company and so-and-so company don't like each other and things like that, but like everyone is rooting for everyone. Like, it's like, no, everyone's out there to make the best thing they can possible, and everyone wants everyone else to succeed. Like, it's like, I remember seeing two guys from Spider-Man, the dev team from Spider-Man, come over and talk to Ashraf and say, like, hey, man, we heard, like, that, you know, you had this awesome animation where you're doing this and doing this. And, like, he was talking back to them, and, like, they were just so excited, like, to talk to each other. And, like, Sam, like, I know I keep bringing up Ashraf, but, you know, we talked a lot. Mm-hmm. Like, he was talking with, like, Corey Balrog, like, who, you know, is a director now on the new God of War, which God of War and AC are literally my two favorite franchises of all time. Mm-hmm. And so, like, seeing the two guys responsible for those games talking and, like, having mutual admiration for one another, it was just, like, it was so amazing.
Dude, that's awesome. That is awesome. Like, for sure, there's an element there of, like, everybody in the games, or from, like, the development side of the games industry, like, has that shared experience of, like, making a game is hard. And, like, there's so many elements to it. There's so many different facets to the roles people need to fill, the positions people need to fill, the time leading up to the game, how hard that can be. And I can only imagine that, like, people within that realm of development probably have that shared experience, and that probably, like, actually builds a bond between them.
Yeah,
I would assume. And so, no, like, yeah.
And you're absolutely right. No, sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
Oh, yeah, no, go ahead.
Well, it's one of those things that, you know, from a PR perspective, you know, we hear about games, you know, a few months in advance, and, you know, we get a little bit of, you know, we have to keep that secret for a bit. But then if you think about it from the development side, these guys are working on games 2-3 years and they can't tell anyone about it.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, I mean, that's hard. That takes a toll on you to, like, go home and, you know, not be able to tell your family, your loved ones, your friends, like, what you do all day. Like, it's for that long of a period of time. It's something I feel like I personally had never really thought about. Mm-hmm. And it, like, you know, credit to our developers, every developer out there, just for putting in, like, the blood, sweat, and tears that it takes to make a game. And, like, everyone out there is really just trying to make the best thing they can possible. Like, which is, like, to me, obviously it's kind of something you know, but you don't necessarily really think about till you see it from that side. And it's just, it's so heartwarming to see.
Yeah, no, it's awesome. Like, and even on this show, I try my hardest to, whenever I'm critiquing something, I'm always shouting out, like, the great things about it, about, like, say it's a game, like, the great thing about the game, how, like, the type of impact it can have. And even, like, when I'm coming from a side of, like, I might be critiquing that something that's negative about the game or bad about the game, I always come from a side of, like, this is the thing that I think you can do better, and even acknowledging that, like, that thing is hard to do, and still, like, it's not, whatever it is, it's not that serious. Like, it's not life or death. And, like, I mean, I know a lot of gamers out there, like, whenever, like, Mass Effect, like, when Mass Effect came out, people were, like, furious about, like, the facial animations, and, like, yeah. I mean, they were pretty bad, but, like, it's, like, days go on, like, there's still more to do out there, and even, like, we can use it as a learning opportunity, figure out a way to be positive through it, and so, yeah, man, that's dope. Real quick, before we move on, I just want to point out a few things. First of all, if people were listening, you heard the announcements before the show, then you'll know that we have a new member of OK Beast, Moises. So I just want to give that a quick shout out. Shout out to Moises. Thank you for joining the team. He's actually joining to be a writer on OKBeast.com. And so you'll see articles from him. He was with Late to the Game. Late to the Game was his thing, latetothegame.com, where he would write about older games. We're adopting that as a column on OKBeast.com. And so every other week, or whatever we decide. I think we decide every other week, but I'm not going to commit to that. But every now and then you'll see articles on OKBeast.com titled Late to the Game. That's Moises, or whoever Moises might recruit to put out those articles about older games, retro games, games that you might not have heard of. And so shout out to Moises. He's also joined to help us with video essays, specifically the script writing, because we are now doing weekly essays every Friday, and that requires some help. And so Moises is gonna be helping out with that. He'll probably eventually start making videos if we start teaching him and all that stuff, and so we're seeing where that goes. But shout out to Moises for joining. And also, I just want to remind people that you should rate us in iTunes, because that helps. And we have shirts on okbeast.com/store. Youssef, so I'm having you on, one, because you're cool and you're dope and you seem like an interesting dude. Also, because I think you have an interesting perspective as a PR person, and even as, like, a PR person for Ubisoft, because, like, if people have listened to this show, like, it's funny because we had an episode where like the topic was why I dislike Ubisoft games, and me and Ian went into it, and I was like it was like a good like 20-minute conversation, and by the end of the conversation, I was like, huh, I don't dislike Ubisoft games. There's one or two franchises that I don't that I'm not into, and like. Those are the ones that keep like it's Assassin's Creed. I'm not that into, and that's mainly because it's not for me. I'm not into like the climbing mechanics the same way. Same reason I'm not into Uncharted. And then like Far Cry, like I can't remember what else. Maybe it was the Crew, and I'm not even a racing person. So like I remember having that conversation, being like, yo, that's hilarious. That like by the end of this conversation, I was like, man, the whole idea of this topic is void because like. Yeah, I came down on the wrong place, but
Shout out to Ian then in that case.
Oh yeah, shout out to Ian. He wasn't the funny thing is he wasn't even trying to defend Ubisoft. He was just like I don't know, I like their games. I don't see anything wrong with their games. And I started Googling. I was like, okay, let's look up some Ubisoft games. For Honor, that was actually all right. Rainbow Six Siege, I haven't played it, and I've heard great things about the game. Let's see what else. Far Cry, I actually love Far Cry. Oh well, I guess I'm wrong. Yeah, shout out to Ian.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's why I'm having you on, because yeah, you have an interesting perspective as a PR person, which is going to be our topic. Yeah. But before we get into that, what have you been up to lately? Like, have you been playing any games or been like watching any TV or heard any news that specifically you want to discuss?
Yeah. So I think in terms of what I've been playing, it's kind of weird. I was maybe like 10, 12 hours. Absolutely loving. I love those type of games. The immersive sim, the Deus Ex, the Dishonored. Loved your video about that, by the way.
Oh, thanks, man.
Yeah, shout out to you. But I was playing through that, and it was kind of just getting a bit too tense, a bit too serious for me. Still love it. Still, I'm gonna go back to it, but wanted to play something a bit more like actiony. So I actually jumped back into Assassin's Creed Black Flag. Played through that a bunch, mostly just because. Again, I'm like really excited about Assassin's Creed Origins and then Skull and Bones down the line. Mm. And Black Flag is made by the team that is making Assassin's Creed Origins. And it's the team that designed the ship combat and that is making Skull and Bones. So I was kind of craving both those games. So I was like, hey, I'll play Black Flag in the meantime. And then like the start of like the busy season, in my opinion, like began. Mm-hmm. Fire came out. So I've been playing Empire for the past week.
How are you liking Empire?
I'm a huge fan of Supergiant. I'm having a lot of fun with it. It's a bit different from their previous games. I don't know if you've played Bastion and Transistor.
I've only played a little bit of Transistor, but I like Supergiant for like their style, and like their games are so unique in terms of their style, story, and mechanics. Like everything about their games is so like this is a Supergiant game. So Empire seems like another one of those for sure.
Yeah, it definitely is. And like, yeah, to me, like, I love their art style. I love their music, actually, in all three games. When I was writing my master's thesis, I was listening to a lot of video game music because it's, I can't remember where, I heard somewhere that like video game music is good to listen to when you're like working because it's designed to help you focus.
Interesting.
And so I literally ran through the entire Transistor soundtrack. And actually, again, I keep bringing this up. I swear it's not just because I'm a Ubisoft person, but AC Black Flag. I listened to those two soundtracks so much. So in 2016, that they were actually Brian Tyler, who's the Black Flag composer, and Darren Korb, who composes all of the Supergiant game soundtracks, were literally two of my top five artists on Spotify last year. Nice. I listened to those so much. So yeah, I'm really liking Pyre right now. And yeah, I'm still not too far into it. I think I'm actually right at a point where things kind of start to shift and starts to change and maybe get a little bit more interesting. So from what I've heard, it only gets better from here.
Yeah, so like Pyre is like a sports game within like a visual novel, right?
Yeah, you kind of nailed it. Most of it, at least from what I played so far, is this kind of visual novel of you talking to these characters. And do you know the basic sort of premise of the game?
Is it that like you play as somebody who can read, and like reading is not allowed in this world? Is that what it is?
Yeah. So basically, there's two kind of worlds. There's the Commonwealth, which is like the main like overworld, and then there's the region you're in, which actually, honestly, I kind of forget the name of it. But basically, it's where the convicts and criminals get sent to. Mm. And you're sent there because you can read. And you sort of team up with this group of other various sort of misfits. And what you do is you compete in these things called rights, which is that like Powerball type of game that you see. And through that, you can earn your sort of like redemption back into the Commonwealth, back into society. And so, yeah, I think the story's setting up some really interesting dynamics, and I'm really intrigued to see where it goes. But the gameplay is also awesome. Like,
is it closest to?
Honestly, if you know what, like, the real sport of handball, like, not like what, like second graders play on the school playground, mm-hmm. but like Olympic handball, it's like pretty similar to that. Like, there's a, you know, a goal on either end, and you're essentially trying to get the orb into your opponent's goal, and they can sort of knock you off with their aura. Every character has this little like halo that goes around them, and that's their aura. And if you have the orb, you don't have an aura, so anyone who touches you with an aura will knock it out of you. But you can also project out your aura, and like each character has different moves that you can sort of use to navigate the playing field. And so it's one of those games that looks really simple the first time you play it, but they start introducing new characters that have new abilities and sort of different masteries and things like that, and it gets real deep real fast.
Interesting. How does it set it up? Is like the sports element, is it blatantly like, oh, okay, we're gonna play a sports game now, or is it like supposed to be like combat, but it's like dressed up in the sports game? Like,
so it's not. I wouldn't say it's combat. And I wouldn't necessarily go so far as to say it's sport. It's more ritual. So
interesting.
They're called rites, and when you begin the rite, you'll see a representative from the other team that's talked to you. And there's team names. Like your team name is the Nightwings, and like you'll go against the Furies or something like that. Like there's a bunch of different. I might be getting it wrong, but there's a bunch of different team names. And you'll like sort of talk and interact with one of them, and there'll be a little bit of smack talk or something going back and forth, and then. You know, if you beat them, there'll be another conversation. And the cool thing about the game, this actually hasn't happened to me yet, but you know, you can lose a right, and the story still progresses. Like it doesn't, it's not like you have to beat everything to progress. And so it'll be interesting to see too, you know, if and when I fail, like what happens and how the story progresses from there.
Dude, that's awesome. Awesome. As far as what I've been up to, aside from what I've been up to, as far as news, actually, NBA Live announced that the WNBA is going to be included in their next game, which I thought was interesting.
I saw that.
Like, usually I don't talk much news on the show, but I saw that and I was like, huh, that's an interesting thing, and I figured I'd bring it up. Do you play NBA Live or NBA in general, like games, like on PlayStation? Because nobody plays NBA Live.
Yeah. I mean, clearly some people do.
Yeah.
I'm gonna be perfectly honest with you. One of my absolute favorite games of all time is NBA Street Volume 2.
Dude, I love you. NBA Street Volume 2 is my jam. I'm undefeated in that game. Like it's legit undefeated in that game.
I mean, the game was kind of broken in terms of like if you like maxed out your block skill, you could just kind of like stand under the hoop and just like block everything. I loved everything about it, the gameplay, the style, the swag, the music, like it was amazing.
Dude, I went on a rant, like literally last episode about how they should bring back EA Sports Big, because those games are all, like NBA Street Volume 2 I think is easily like the best game they put out, but like SSX, Tricky 2, like 3,
literally SSX, Tricky, and NBA Street Volume 2 are two of my top five games of all time.
Yeah.
Like there's no game I'm better at than Tricky. Like I'm confident in saying going up to people and just being I'm better than you at SSX Tricky. It's the only game I'm confident in my abilities in.
I think NBA Street Volume 2 is like one of those games for me where like if anybody wants to, if I had to pick games to go head to head at with people, like FIFA would be in there. NBA Street Volume 2 would be in there, and like Last of Us multiplayer for some reason would be in there. Like NBA Street Volume 2, though, man, that game is my jam.
Yeah, no, such a game. So I honestly haven't really played a basketball game since then. The occasional like you know pick a game with friends of like 2K like we'll get played, But I've always been much more of a sort of football guy. But yeah, no, shout out to NBA Live for doing that, just because it's, I mean, you're essentially doubling the size of your roster in your game and you know, bringing in a whole another league of people, of women. So, you know, good on them for that.
I mean, I think that's super dope. Like, they started off with, they did that a couple years ago with FIFA, and I thought that was cool. To do it for NBA, I think, is big because there are two NBA franchises in gaming right now, and that's NBA Live and NBA 2K. And 2K is, like, the dominant one. And I think this is something, because lately, this is a weird thing to say, but lately I've been thinking about NBA Live, and I've been thinking about, like, what NBA Live could do to, like, get any sort of leg up. And, like, I've been thinking, like, if they sell it at a discounted price, that could be, like, a great way to, like, $40 instead of $60 could, like, kind of give people incentive to be like, oh, man, maybe I will go NBA Live instead. Or, like I don't even know what else, because I don't know NBA games that well. But I think including the WNBA, I think, is great because it's actually something that is super unique. Like, it's super, like, I don't know if the WNBA has had, like, a dedicated game before.
Yeah.
Like, I would assume this is the first time. And I would think that this would probably put pressure on 2K to see if they can get the WNBA or any kind of women's basketball in some of their future games, which I think would be super huge. Because I make fun of, like, NBA Live all the time, even though, like, I love the older NBA Lives. Lately, I've been more disappointed by them. But, like, 2K is on, like, another level, and any kind of pressure on them to get the WNBA Live in there, I think, would be off the chain.
I think I'm always for sort of, like, competition in that sense of, like, trying to make franchises better by having competition. And, like, we kind of reached, like, a bit of monopoly in sports games where, like, 2K is the basketball game, like, the show is the baseball game, Madden is the football game. So, like, I'm all for bringing in, like, more franchises, having them do unique things if that's what they got to do to get noticed. And yeah, as far as, you know, having the WNBA in there, like, I don't know, I'll watch the occasional WNBA game, and, like, they're awesome to watch. Like, it's a totally different feel from the NBA, totally different vibe, and it's you know, just as entertaining, I think.
Yeah, and I have a friend named Laura. We were super cool friends in high school, and she was on the basketball team. And, like, she's super into basketball. I think, I'm pretty sure that's what she wants to do with her life. And, like, I couldn't imagine how hyped she is for NBA Live. Like, I could only imagine, like, dude, she must be super hyped for it. And so, yeah, shout out to NBA Live for that. And I just wanted to bring that up because I thought that was cool. But as far as what I've actually done or I've actually played, I finished Doom literally yesterday.
Oh, which, wow. What'd you think?
Dude, I loved it. Like, that game is dope. Have you played it?
Yes. Yeah. I played that not right when it came out, but maybe like 6 months later. Yeah. Absolutely loved it. One of my earliest gaming memories actually is playing Doom on my dad's PC.
Nice.
Like, the original, way back in the day when I was way too young to play a game like that. But
dude, that's awesome.
It was great.
Yeah, like, I think I talked about it last week, so I won't go too deep into it. But, like, last week, I think I'd probably finished about maybe half of it, and I finally finished it. And, like, that game is so, like, one, I wasn't listening to the soundtrack too closely for the first half of it, because since the game isn't really heavy on story, for games like that, usually I would either watch shows or I'd listen to podcasts. And so, like, I finished all of Arrow and Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. while, like, playing Doom. The last season's not, like, the whole shows, but, like, I finished those while playing Doom, and I've just been, like, catching up on stuff and listening to podcasts.
Oh, wow. Wait, so you do TV shows and games at the same time?
Yeah, because I have two TVs in my room, and so I'll just do it. Yeah.
That's impressive. Okay, because I've done podcasts and games, but I've never done both of those.
Yeah, this is probably my first time actually, like, playing a whole game while watching whole seasons. Like, usually, like, I would try to pull it off with other games. I just can't. Like, eventually I'll be like, this isn't working, and I just focus on one. Doom is so, like, chill. Like, I don't care at all what they're talking about in Doom, or, like, what kind of what's the story is. And, like, I can do that. And Arrow isn't really a show you need to watch. You can listen to Arrow and still get everything out of it, because, like, there's action, but, like, every action scene in Arrow is the exact same thing. Like, if you've seen one episode of Arrow, you've seen every episode of Arrow in terms of like their choreography and stuff.
I watched the first four seasons of Arrow, and then just life got in the way, and I fell behind on season 5 of Arrow and season 3 of Flash. But I know they're on Netflix now. I need to catch up on those.
Man, was this last season season 5 of Arrow? I can't remember.
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah. This last season starts off kind of slow, but like ends off well. Like it's great towards the end. Nice. And so I'd recommend it. Do you watch Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.?
I don't. No.
That's a great show. Like it starts off, also starts off boring. Like the first 17 episodes are like kind of whack, with like some good ones in there. But like episode 17 is the episode that comes out after the movie Captain America, Winter Soldier.
That's when the big Hydra shakeup happens.
Yeah, yeah, and like that changes the whole show. Like from there, the show is just great. And so yeah, that show's awesome. I assume it's 17. Don't correct me if you're listening to this. It's somewhere around that though. But yeah, no, like that show's awesome. Arrow's awesome. And Doom's awesome. Like I started listening to the soundtrack like halfway through. Like I started listening to the game with like headphones on and stuff. That soundtrack is crazy.
Yeah.
And I was watching like videos on it. Apparently, like for one of the songs, they sampled a chainsaw, like the sound of a chainsaw, and turned it into a synth, and that's how they made the guitar riff. And I'm like, that's like they do some crazy things in that game to like make it like next level, make it extreme. And like the act, like the movement in that game is off the chain because it's not like. It's not emphasizing hide behind covers, which is a thing I'm not really a fan of in shooting games. Like, I complain about Uncharted all the time. And half of that is because like I don't like the pop out from cover kind of thing, or like hiding behind something for a while and then popping out when I have the chance. Like Doom emphasizes like movement and like everything is just going at all times. Like, you have to keep killing people to get that health back. You got to keep killing people to get that ammo back.
The glory kills. Like,
yeah.
If you stand in one spot and just shoot, you're going to die.
You're going to die. Yeah. If you try to hide behind something, you're going to die. Like, and there's nothing to hide behind anyway. Like, you have to keep going and keep killing things as fast as you can so you can stay alive and have ammo. That setup is just so perfect. And that game is super fun for that. I really enjoyed that.
Nice.
I also have been playing Last of Us multiplayer, which is really random. But
how many people are still playing that? Like, I'm surprised.
So the people that are playing online right now are all just experts. Like,
okay.
All just dedicated players. And so, like, if you hop in right now, you'll just get decimated.
Yeah.
And there's not that many people playing anymore. But I really love that multiplayer. And I got into it randomly because I used to play all the time when the game first came out. But I never played with people because I didn't have anybody to play with, but I was randomly playing the Lawbreakers beta with Moises and Alex Van Aken, and I think me and Moises were just talking about like how like we're talking about multiplayer games, and Alex was talking about how he's into Splinter Cell, the Spies versus Mercs, I think is what it's called. I never played Splinter Cell, but he was talking about that, and me and Moises were like, oh dude, you know what multiplayer we love? Last of Us. And we just started getting into it, and we were like, dude, we should play Last of Us right now. And like, we were like, are we about to play Last of Us? Let's play Last of Us. And we just started, and we've been playing multiple nights since then. Like, it's such a good multiplayer mode. If you haven't played Last of Us multiplayer, essentially it is there's a very high emphasis on stealth and listening, and I'd like to think that it's similar to PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds, but everybody who I've asked about it says it's not. And so it's what I think PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds is, even though I haven't played it. Mode we play is like 4v4 survival, and so it's like last man standing. And like, yeah, the whole time you're just crouched and you're listening for people and you're crafting stuff so you can have better weapons, have like bombs and all this stuff. You have to like craft everything, first aid. And yeah, it's almost like paintball where like you get somebody and they're out, and it's dope. Nice. Yeah. Did you ever play Last of Us multiplayer?
I want to say I maybe played a couple matches, but like never like got too deep into it. Yeah, that was I mean, like, yeah, to me, I thought at the time, like, it was kind of just like, I thought of it just kind of like as Uncharted multiplayer, which like, I never played a whole lot of. But I mean, I've heard a lot of people say the things you're saying, like, echo the sentiments of it's really deep, it's like really unique. I know a few people who've gotten lost in it.
It's so good. I've played Uncharted multiplayer, and I didn't really get too into it. But Last of Us, I think the multiplayer is dope because it is like, it's very slow and methodical, as opposed to like Uncharted, which is more run and gun. And Last of Us multiplayer, like, it's almost perfect, except that there are DLC weapons that you can buy, which kind of break the game a little bit. Like, there's like a shotgun that you can pay like $1 or $2 for, like actual dollars, and that thing is devastating, and I kind of hate it for that. But
Wait, so let me ask you: did you ever play Assassin's Creed multiplayer?
No, I played Assassin's Creed 1 and 2 single player, but I never played multiplayer.
Okay, yeah. So multiplayer didn't come out until Brotherhood. I actually think you'd really like that.
Yeah.
Like based off of how you describe The Last of Us multiplayer, like, it's unlike anything I had played before that. It's like, I don't know if you know how it works. It's basically, there's a level with a whole bunch of NPCs walking around, and then you pick a various character that looks like one of those NPCs. So maybe there's 20 different NPCs, like, or skins walking around the map, and there's 8 players within that map that look like one of those NPCs. And you have a target, and you are someone else's target, and you have to try and fit, you have to try and blend in, but at the same time figure out which one of, like, who your target is, because, and how to tell them apart from just a regular old NPC, while not necessarily standing out yourself. And it's like this awesome game of like cat and mouse of like just trying to like fit, blend in, but then like capitalizing when your target makes a mistake or reveals themselves, and like you'll get into these epic chases, and then, or you'll see a chase go by and realize that like the guy doing the chasing is the guy you're trying to kill, and it's got a really interesting dynamic.
Dude, that's awesome. I might do you know if, man, maybe I shouldn't, because I have it, I think I have like the 360 Assassin's Creed games downloaded on my Xbox because they like games with gold. Should I check those out on there, or should I like wait and see for like maybe like the one coming up?
I think definitely check it out. See,
I don't even know if those servers are still up.
To be honest, I'm not sure either. But I definitely think it's something that if you get the chance to play, it's definitely worth checking out. Like, to me that was, I mean, and again, this was, Brotherhood came out, I was a junior in college. Like, it was, I was not a Ubisoft employee or anything like that. Like, it was a really fun breath of fresh air, I thought.
Nice, man. Nice. All right, well, we'll go ahead and take a break, and when we come back, we'll get into our topics. And we're back. Our topic this week is all about you, Youssef. And so, essentially, I want to kind of talk about, well, first of all, you in general. Like, I start off this podcast with, like, who are you? Which might have been a mistake. I should have waited till you hear it. But what do you do at Ubisoft? I guess I can start with that.
Yeah. So, I'm on the PR team there, and working on... like specific titles. So I work on For Honor and Ghost Recon Wildlands, and then upcoming games will be Far Cry 5 and Skull and Bones. And basically, I don't know, what I really like about the job is that no day is really ever the same twice. Things are always kind of different. You're, you know, depending on what's going on in like the season, or, you know, in terms of game launches or events, things like that, things are always kind of changing. One thing that, you know, kind of always happens is, you know, I'll typically read coverage. So going to IGN, GameSpot, Polygon, Kotaku, GameFormer, like all the, you know, all those sites and even more that, you know, there's a whole, I was somebody who read a lot of, you know, gaming news, gaming sites. There's a ton of sites I never knew about even that I now check regularly as part of work, see what people are writing about our games, saying about our games, things like that. And then, yeah, I mean, after that, things kind of change with the season, with, you know, whatever sort of games we have coming out or anything like that. Or if we have, you know, E3 obviously is a really busy time. Right now we're, you know, gearing up for Gamescom and PAX West, things like that.
What does that look like? Like when you're gearing up for something, what is the process? What is the process like? What exactly are you doing in the, during that time?
Yeah, I mean, so that typically starts with figuring out what games we're showing, if any. And then once that happens, deciding to, you know, are these going to be playable? Are we going to have a panel maybe? Things like that. And then sort of reaching out to people, seeing who's coming, or inviting people to come, various, you know, press, things like that. And then, yeah, you know, preparing in terms of like something like E3, there's, you know, a whole sort of portion of it that's scheduled, and you have press appointments, things like that. So a lot of my work going into E3 was scheduling all those press appointments. And so really for every event, it kind of changes. It's kind of fluid. Every event sort of has its own sort of different requirements, and we sort of tailor our events or each tailor our showings a bit differently to each event. So yeah, it's fun. It's always different. You know, you don't plan E3 like you do PAX.
That's awesome, actually. Let's talk about just exactly that. So like PAX, right, is more like community focused, more like it's more about the people playing the games and interacting with them directly, versus E3, which is more about like press and it's more of a professional thing. What's different about preparing for those two? Is there more like preparation for like PAX since there's more people, or like what does that look like? I imagine E3 is also like super huge because it's E3. Like, what are like the, I mean, whether it's stress levels or like actual things that you like, what does that look like?
Yeah. I mean, I think scale is the biggest thing, really. Whereas, you know, E3, we go and we reveal a whole bunch of games that never been seen before. We, you know, there's a press conference, there's a massive booth and everything like that. Like there's essentially all of our titles, not always, but like there's quite a few games on the show floor. Whereas PAX is a bit smaller, a bit, obviously, like you said, a bit more community fan driven. It's more of a consumer show, whereas E3 is, you know, an industry work show. And so obviously you want to tailor that experience, change that experience, where, you know, PAX, you want to get fans to be able to, you know, have fun and interact and play your game, things like that. Where, yeah, like I said, E3 is, there's a lot of stuff that goes into the press conference, a lot of stuff that goes into, you know, press appointments, things like that. And so that's mainly how they're different. Like I said, this is, you know, or maybe I didn't say actually, I haven't been at Ubisoft for a year yet. So all of these events are my first one. Mm-hmm. So E3 was my first one. This will be my first PAX. And so, you know, I don't know everything just yet.
I didn't even ask you like how long you've been working at Ubisoft. So like, when did you start, by the way?
So I started last November. So I've only been there for a little over 8 months now.
What has been your favorite part so far?
By far, the people, actually, which is kind of the same answer I gave you about E3. But yeah, like people will ask me that, and you know, I think a lot of people are expecting to say like, oh, you know, I play games all day, which I definitely don't. Yeah, to me, like, especially the people I interact with on a daily basis, on the PR team, on the marketing teams, are just awesome people, really fun to be around, really great at their jobs, really hardworking, really care about what they do. And it's an awesome place to get to be and to get to work.
Who's your favorite person on
favorite person? Ooh, I mean,
I told you I'm trying not to get you in trouble, but yeah, I figured this one would be okay.
I mean, clearly you're not, if you're asking me that. No, I mean, honestly, I couldn't tell you. like, it's like I really do love all the people I work with. Like, it is we're like a very close team. All of them are a ton of fun to be around and interact with, and you know, it's kind of like, you know, it's trying to pick your, you know, out of a friend group, you know, who you like the most.
I mean, you can go ahead and say Eves if you want to. I mean, that's the homie right there. That's the homie. I love, so like it's funny because I went from saying like I'm not a fan of Ubisoft, but like E3 I loved Ubisoft at least for like the personality and like the human aspect that they brought toward their conference. Like seeing that like moment with like the Mario Rabbids and seeing Miyamoto come out. Was it Miyamoto? It was Miyamoto, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Seeing Miyamoto come out and sort of give shout outs and seeing like the emotion there. I was like, man, that's awesome. That's dope. And like, I feel like that was like the one conference where I was like, that was a pretty human conference. And also like Bethesda's beginning, how they begun their conference with like the family thing, I thought was dope.
I mean, I can't think of the last press conference where you had two different developers cry. And that's what I said. I feel like you kind of got to see a little bit of that during like our conference of that human side of E3. And like that to me was my favorite part of just this means so much to everyone here. Mm-hmm. Like the people in this industry are just amazing.
Yeah. So you do PR, and I know for a fact that like people listening, there are a lot of people listening who are interested actually like in the inner workings of the games industry, and specifically like how they can get into the games industry or get into like something like either media or PR or development or whatever it may be. What did that road look like for you? Like, how did you get to where you are?
Okay, yeah. So this is gonna be a very roundabout answer. I did not have a traditional sort of road down this path at all. I'll start in college. I went to Tufts University. It's a liberal arts school in just outside Boston, Massachusetts. I studied art and architecture there. I got my degree in architectural studies. Was very into classical art and architecture. So I studied abroad in Florence. I got my minor in Roman archaeology. So sort of studying Renaissance Italian architecture, and then also antiquity, Greek and Roman antiquity, which is obviously what influences the Renaissance. And was really into that. Decided when I went to Florence, I did some architecture studio courses. Decided I wanted to be an architect. So I went to grad school to become an architect. I went to UCLA for grad school. The plan was to get my master's of design, essentially, in architecture. It was a 3-year degree. I did a year of it and decided after a year that I didn't want to be an architect. And then after that year, during the end of that year, I was sort of debating what I wanted to do. I considered transferring schools, things like that. I decided to stay at UCLA and transfer into their academic master's in architecture degree, which basically means you're doing more theory than you are than you're doing design. You're not really doing any design. I basically went from making drawings and designing 3D models of buildings to writing essays. And there was one class in particular, it was in one of our graduate seminars, where we were reading some text, and it was pretty old. I want to say it was somewhere early 90s, 80s, but it was this by a guy named Lev Manovich. Mm-hmm. And he's talking about, it was old enough that they were referred to as computer games, at least, I remember that. And he mentioned something about computer games being more algorithmic than they were databases. He was comparing algorithms and databases. Mm-hmm. And he sort of skewed computer games onto the side of algorithm. And at that time, the hype for No Man's Sky was like pretty big. It hadn't reached peak levels of fervor, but it was something that I was really excited for. And to me, No Man's Sky, I've always been more interested in how it's made than necessarily anything else about it. Even though I love the game, I put in, you know, probably 60 hours into it. Mm-hmm. And so, but I was thinking in a lot of ways, No Man's Sky is kind of both, where it's a game sort of through procedural generation that's built by what you could call algorithms, but through that becomes a database into itself and is built actually from a database. So if you have all these different component parts, you have all these rules and regulations, and that's how procedural generation works. There's a set of rules and lists, and based off that, it procedurally generates forms and animals, plants, things like that. And so there's actually Lev Manovich, and I'm totally forgetting the name of the essay that he wrote, and then No Man's Sky, that I realized, wait, there's space for me to talk about games in architecture school. And so that was my first year, my second year at UCLA, but my first year in that academic program. And then I wrote my sort of next term paper on defining games through space, of whether they're, talking about side scrollers, mm-hmm. Top-down games, third-person games, first-person games, things like that, categorizing by space and how each of those spaces gives different meaning to the game, gives different meaning to your actions in the game. And then from that, I kind of became the video game guy and realized that's actually what I wanted to do my master's thesis on, which in a school, in an architecture school, nobody, at least in my experience, nobody knew anything about games. To paint you an idea, at UCLA, the master's students and the PhD students take all the coursework together. Basically, the first 2 years of your PhD are essentially the 2 years of your master's degree. So everyone's sort of on the same level. And I'm the youngest person in my program at the time. A lot of people are married, have families, they're in their 30s, things like that, don't really play games, are very much obsessed with architecture. And that's kind of what I was thinking about doing a PhD myself, and I realized you kind of have to be obsessed with something mm-hmm. to really go for the PhD. And I realized I just had too varied of interests at the time. So I just kind of just stuck with the master's in that sense. But I'm going in and I'm having to educate my professors, my classmates about games, and trying to make it understandable to them through an architectural lens while trying to talk about them through an architectural lens as well. And so I ended up writing my master's thesis on the ways in which architecture stimulates two sort of disparate and separate forms of attention, or in this case, immersion in video games. Mm. And really that architecture is what is necessary for games to be immersive in a way. And so there's a lot of, I've read a lot of video game theory, and there's a lot that's written about the representational aspects of immersion. What I mean by that is like what something looks like. Oh, the graphics are so good, right? Like this Uncharted 4 looks so real. It's so immersive. And then there's the participatory aspect of immersion, which is relatively unique to games, right? This is the interactive part. This is, I'm playing Tetris and I'm really immersed, right? I'm playing this. It's so fun. I'm so engaged in it. And there's a lot of people that talk about those two different things separately. But what I was really trying to say is that they're joined, they're together, and that's what makes games unique. And the other art form that shares that is unique in that way is architecture. Mm-hmm. Games, I think to this day, people still struggle to classify how to analyze them, how to talk about them from an art perspective. That happens with every new artistic technological art form that enters sort of into the discourse of fine art. Photography, when it's first introduced, people have to sort of come to grips with, all right, how do we talk about this, right? Why is this art? Photography is not looked at as art when it's first introduced in the 19th century. People say, oh, any idiot can sit there and push a button, right? Where's the artistry? Where's the skill? Similarly, right now, I think video games are going through that growing pain of, okay, how do we talk about these things? How do we analyze them in a way that's different from just using what we have with the other art forms? And so that's something, and to be fair, it's something I greatly struggled with. Like I talk about games from a perspective of painting, a perspective of architecture, mm-hmm. A film even, and you kind of I think at the beginning, you need that theoretical substructure that you get from those other established art forms to be able to talk about a new thing, you know, because in the grand scheme of art, you know, video games are you know, microscopic on the timeline of art in general. And so I think people are still really trying to come around to that. And it's something that I was trying to do and something I still try to do and still kind of struggle with. Mm-hmm. That was a kind of a big tangent.
Dude, that's an awesome tangent. I was like, I'm super obsessed with what you just said. I like that way of viewing video games and like that way of, I like breaking down games and so the different elements of them and kind of the different ways you can interact with the game or the different things that like count as gameplay and why is gameplay fun? What do the different kinds of gameplay look like? How does that interact with story? How does that interact with visuals or graphics or whatever? Like, I like breaking stuff down and looking at them at like a more like kind of spread out, like you spread everything out and kind of like pick at a thing at a time. And what you just kind of explained, I think, is a super dope, like, looking at things from the lens of an architect is pretty cool. But yeah, sorry, continue.
No, and I mean, and there's a lot of crossover, especially with architecture and video games, in terms of, like, especially now, the software we're using to design buildings isn't very different from, you know, the software people use to build games. Like, some mm-hmm. school, actually, UCLA, some people use Maya to design their mm-hmm. buildings, which is obviously what a lot of game developers use. Mm-hmm. And I think game development is one of those interesting things of you see a lot more architects going into that just because, one, there's a lot more jobs in it. The pay tends to be better. And you're unrestricted by reality in a way, mm-hmm. Which is something that's kind of nice for architects. But so after that, I graduated from UCLA. I got a job at SF MoMA, San Francisco Museum of Modern Art, as a private guide, which I actually still work there today. Mm-hmm. It was sort of an on-call job. I give private tours there. Basically, people pay a whole lot of money to have me show them around the museum for an hour or two, and which is a job I absolutely love. And it was something that I always kind of thought, like, I've always loved museums. I've always loved art. I had always kind of wanted to work in a museum. So to me, it was kind of like a, oh, this will get me my foot in the door kind of thing. And then I'll, you know, get a full-time job at the museum. And while I was doing that, I was actually freelancing. I've written three different pieces for Killscreen, at the time, writing about, you know, games and architecture. And I was realizing I was kind of trying to get into the gaming industry. And I literally had a thought of, hey, you know, I'm a fairly good communicator. I know this industry fairly well. Maybe I could do PR. And at that time, I met up with a friend of mine that I had met when I was studying abroad in Florence, hadn't seen in, you know, 5 years or so. I mentioned to her I was thinking about this, and she told me, hey, I know someone you should talk to. I met up with that woman, and she had been working in tech PR. She happened to know someone who worked at Ubisoft. Mm-hmm. And sort of helped introduce me, like pass my resume along, and then about a month later, they hired me.
Dude, that's you're right. That is a very roundabout way of getting there.
yeah, not the most direct way at all.
That's awesome though. Like I like all that. This is a super super random question that's like circling back to like an earlier point. No. Have you given like a private tour of that museum to like any like famous people that people would know?
Famous people that people would know. I have not.
No. Okay.
I did give a tour to someone that was very, very like well known. But I wasn't necessarily, it was so sort of secretive that I wasn't even told who it was. I just kind of figured it out along the way. Mm. And I probably shouldn't say that on a public podcast.
Smart, really.
Yeah, so I won't, definitely not. it was like my fourth tour ever, and it was like a very important group of people. But yeah, I other than that, I haven't given any famous people tours.
That's awesome though. Like I asked that because there's like a Donald Glover lyric that about the moment. I can't remember what the lyric is, but I was like, man, I wonder if he's given like any like crazy people, like crazy isn't like crazy famous people, like tour. That'd be crazy.
I will say though that, well, I mean, if you count Joey Noel and Sean Pence as famous,
oh yeah, dude, for sure.
Yeah, I've given them tours. but actually, one of the dopest parties I've ever, probably the dopest parties I've ever been to, was the SF MoMA birthday bash. Mm-hmm. So it was the like first annual. Basically, the museum closed down for 3 years to like expand, and then reopened in 2016. And then to like celebrate that reopening, there was like a huge party they threw. Mm-hmm. And so I got to go, and it was, I got to meet, do you know Lay Twins?
Yeah, dude, I love Lay Twins. You know I'm a dancer, right?
Yeah. I figured you would know, actually.
And so they're like legends. So you met Lay Twins? That's awesome.
I legit got to dance with Lay Twins.
That's amazing. That's awesome, dude.
And I've never felt more incompetent on a dance floor in my entire life. And I like to think of myself as a fairly good dancer, but not nearly on their level. Mm-hmm. I got to meet them through the museum, which was awesome. My girlfriend's coming in right now. That was your sort of tangent, or your question circling back.
Oh yeah, no, you're good. You're good. Yeah, no, I'm just still happy about Lay Twins. Now they're like, for people who are listening who don't know who Lay Twins is, like they're twins, obviously, and they dance, and they are, it's almost, they dance as if they're one person, which is crazy. Like their movements are so in sync. And like, it's not like they're doing like, I mean, they're doing choreography, but it's not like they're doing like the same movements. It's like freestyle choreography, and they're doing like different moves, but they flow together so well, and they do battles all the time, and they're just crazy.
Yeah, well, they toured with Beyonce for a while.
Yeah, they did,
and they and now they're on World of Dance.
Yeah,
yeah. They're by far the best dancers I've ever seen in person, like in real life.
Oh yeah, for sure. Man, I wish I could see them though. But yeah, last question for this portion of the show, or this section, I should say. Are there any games that you personally are looking forward to from Ubisoft? I know this is like a hard left turn from the subject matter, but I have it written down here, so I figured I should, might as well ask it.
No. So yeah, I mean, obviously, I mentioned it already, but Assassin's Creed Origins, obviously, like I said, I never thought I'd get to play a game like this, and so I'm so excited for it. And the fact that it's one of my favorite franchises of all time that's letting me, you know,
man,
play as an Egyptian in ancient Egypt, like I'm
dude, that's awesome.
Beyond stoked for it.
That's awesome.
And to be honest, like it's gonna sound like this like generic, you know, candid answer, but like I really am excited for all of our games coming down the line. Mm-hmm. Like Mario and Rabbids, awesome. You know, South Park is gonna be awesome, I think. You know, Far Cry, and then, you know, further down the line, just like everything we have coming, I'm really excited for.
Mm. I'm super hyped for South Park. Like, I loved Stick of Truth, and I remember after Stick of Truth came out, the first thing I said was like, man, I want a sequel with like the superhero storyline, like since they had like the coon and all that stuff. Like I was like, man, if they did a game on just that storyline, I'd be sold. And I mean, here it is, like Fractured But Whole is coming out soon. I was like when that was announced, I was like, dude, there are certain games that have been announced lately where I'm like, are people reading my mind? Like Mario Odyssey was one of those other games where I was like, are they reading my mind? Where like Mario Odyssey, I had a dream about that game. Like I had
wait. So you're telling me you weren't thinking about a Mario and Rabbids crossover?
that game, I didn't. That game, that was like a hard left. Like when that leaked, I was like, huh, interesting. Like I ain't mad, I'm just like, I'm interested. Like I want to see what this is. And even when Ubisoft showed it at E3, I was like, okay, this makes sense for what it is. Like I was expecting something way crazier, but this is actually like within the realm of like sanity. Nintendo's like, Ubisoft is pretty like when Ubisoft does something, I'm never like, oh, that's crazy. Ubisoft is very, I guess you should say, normal in how they approach things. Whereas like Nintendo can bust something out and you can be like, what are you, like they, ARMS, when they announced ARMS, I was like, what are you guys thinking? This is weird, but this looks kind of cool, but it's weird. And yeah, Mario and Rabbids is one of those things where I was like, man, this is Nintendo's weirdness mixed with Ubisoft like Rabbids or whatever, but at E3 I was like, okay, I see what this is. Mario Odyssey, I was like, you people are reading my mind for what I want from a game.
That's awesome. Sorry, was the question just UE games or all?
I mean, in general, are there any games that you're excited for?
Obviously, really excited for Uncharted Lost Legacy. Mm-hmm. I think this very easily has the potential to be my favorite Uncharted.
Really? Interesting.
Yeah. Just from like the perspective they're going at with this one, and like the fact that you're playing as two women of color in the game, like I'm really excited about.
That is crazy, isn't it? Like, I can't think of another game that has that. Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah, yeah. I'm really looking forward to it. And obviously, yeah, those games are just so well polished. Probably the game, the non-Ubisoft game I'm most excited about though this entire year, is Middle Earth: Shadow of War. Which, because I bought a PlayStation 4 to play Shadow of Mordor, like the original.
Yeah.
Just because I love that world. Everything about that game was speaking to me in terms of like being fun, having this like super deep nemesis system, having these dynamic sort of emergent, you know, gameplay narratives come out of it. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, exceeded all of my expectations in the original. So I'm totally sold on Shadow of War.
Yeah, I'm the same. Like, I remember seeing the first trailer and being like, man, this game looks amazing. And if the game's anywhere near as amazing as this trailer looks, it was like a gameplay trailer, or it was like a demonstration kind of thing where they're kind of like breaking down, like, this is what happens, and then you can take over this guy.
I love their promo materials like that, of like, hey, we're going to do this in-depth walkthrough, and like, there's a narrator. And like,
yeah,
we're gonna,
I love that so much. That's my favorite thing. Like, as somebody who works in PR, make that happen for literally everything. Everything I'll do, just put a narrator on it.
We actually did for Ghost Recon and Wildlands. We had like taking down like a base kind of like during the day and during the night. Like there was like a narrator. Yeah.
Anytime that happens, I'm just straight up just sold. No matter what the game is, it could be for like straight up. It could be for Mario, like just like have Mario walk. This is Mario getting the star. Just like do all that. I'm sold on everything. But yeah, no, like after I saw that trailer for Middle Earth, I was like, man, there's no way that this would be this good. And then I played it, I was like, oh no, it's exactly this good. Like it's exactly that, and it's exactly as fun as I thought it would be. And it's like, it's robust, and this nemesis thing is crazy. And like, I'm hyped for that too.
Yeah, I need to load up my most recent save, because I know you can transfer over your nemesis. So I gotta do that before it launches.
Yeah, dude, I'm super hyped for that. And even like, to circle back, like, I'm excited for you for the Assassin's Creed thing. I keep forgetting the name of the game. Which one is this coming up?
Assassin's Creed Origins.
Origins. That's what I thought. For some reason, I thought it was an Origins. But as far as like playing as like an Egyptian main character, I think that's super dope. Like, I don't think I've had like a moment in like, well, recently actually, the moment has been Doomfist for me, where like I'm Nigerian and Doomfist is Nigerian, and like he's a villain, but I don't care. I love villains. And like, I remember him being announced, I didn't realize I knew Doomfist was a character. I didn't realize before that he was Nigerian. I thought he was just like a big black dude. And I was watching like the announcement video from Jeff Kaplan, and he mentioned that he was Nigerian. I was like, wait, what? Mm-hmm. And then I was like, oh dude, this is awesome. Like I usually never get to play a character that's like this, like the same race as me, I assume. Like, I don't know much of Doomfist's backstory because I haven't looked into it that much, but having him be also Nigerian, have that shared heritage and all that stuff is has me excited to explore that character and play as that character. And like, for it to be your favorite game, that's like another like, dude, that's crazy. Like, that's like if Mario 64, or not Mario 64, but if like if they came out with Mario Odyssey and you booted up the game and he was Nigerian, like that'd be like that's kind of like what that would be like for me. And so yeah, that's awesome. But let's take another quick break, and when we get back, we'll get into questions. And we're back with questions. Our first question comes from Sean Pitts. He asks, how does Youssef feel about weightlifting gloves? don't know what this means.
So in addition to being Nick Scarpino's personal trainer, I was also Sean. I'm also Sean Pitts' personal trainer. Both of those dudes, though, I do have to give a quick shout out, because two of the most hardworking dudes I know, like extreme grinders in every sense of the word, like work their butts off all day, and then they let me, you know, go and beat them up at the gym, or they go off and they do jujitsu on their own, and then afterwards, you know, Sean will go back to work, Nick goes to a stand-up club, like these dudes are grinders to the utmost extent. Weightlifting clubs, though, again, it's a personal taste. I don't like to wear them, mostly because I actually kind of like getting calluses on my hand. I like feeling that sort of that roughness of the skin. I also typically, I'm always like fidgeting with something, so it's kind of nice. It gives me something to sort of like scratch at or you know, pick at. So I kind of like getting that like tangible like feeling of, you know, I've listened to something heavy, and so I'm not necessarily personally, for me, a fan of weightlifting those, but you know, if someone is, then more power to you.
Nice. Sean actually asked a few questions. The second question is, how many whole chickens can you eat in one sitting?
So if I'm being honest, it really depends where the chicken's coming from. Because if you go to Safeway, Safeway's got those small chickens. I could probably eat, you know, three of those. We're talking like a Costco chicken. I might cap myself at around two.
So you're like, you eat a lot, I'm guessing.
Oh yeah. I mean, that's part of, yeah, I said at the beginning, you know, me, all my friends, we're thick guys. That's part of that thickness. You just got to be able to eat. Essentially, how we kind of tend to, you know, joke around and describe it is like being thick is essentially being fat, but you lift weights. So you don't necessarily get fat.
You're swole.
Yeah, I mean, that's the hope.
That's like what you're striving towards, the swole.
Yeah, exactly.
Nice. His last question here is, if you could reboot any franchise ever and make Idris Elba the lead, what franchise would it be?
All right, so I feel like there's an obvious answer to this, which is James Bond. For one, I think Idris Elba is like the pinnacle of man. He and The Rock, you know, kind of like a 1A, 1B kind of thing.
Agreed.
So that's the easy answer. And like those movies I like grew up watching, my dad kind of like brought me up watching those movies. It was like one of those things that like that we really had it in common. And so, like, it is a series kind of near and dear in my heart, and I really do think it actually needs a reboot, just because I've kind of fell out of it now, and I think they could modernize it in a really interesting way. But that's the easy answer. My more sort of controversial blessing answer here for you, hot take right now, Star Wars.
I was not expecting that. I was going to, my answer is Batman, but Star Wars is out of nowhere. Why do you say Star Wars?
Yeah, I feel like there's been enough reboots of Batman lately.
That's actually true. That's also very true.
So some people know this about me. I'm not the biggest Star Wars fan. I know that tends to be sacrilege in the video game nerd community. I also, and again, I'm going to get a lot of, you know, response from this. I actually enjoy the prequels more so. Original trilogy.
There's a girl at my work that says the same thing, and I always make fun of her for it. And to be honest, I can't remember the prequels. Like, they could be great. I watched them when I was a kid, and I don't remember them.
I mean, I've spent a lot of time trying to defend the prequels and legitimize my sort of passion for them. That's probably for another podcast on another day. To be fair, Episode 7 and Rogue One. Rogue One is my favorite Star Wars movie. Episode 7 is number 2. So I like where the series is going now, but I would be totally down for like a reboot. Go, you know, this is a, like, every movie starts with a galaxy far, far away. We're talking about an entire galaxy. Maybe we can like get away from this one family that like everything seems to be centered on. Like, go tell an entirely different story, reboot it. Give me Idris Elba. Give him a lightsaber. You know, make him a badass. Like, I'm sold. Sign me up.
I like it. I'm the biggest Luther fan. Like, Luther is one of my favorite shows.
I love Luther. Yeah,
it's so good, dude. Like, the moment in the first episode where he's interrogating I can't remember her name. He's interrogating the girl.
Alice.
Right. Yeah. He's interrogating her and he's trying to figure out like what's up with her, like what's going on. And he yawns, and she doesn't yawn. And he walks out and he's like, "It's her." And people are like, "What?" And he's like, "She didn't yawn. It's her." Like that moment, I'm like, "Man, I'm gonna love this show." And sure enough, like that show became one of my favorite shows. It's so good. Except for this. I was gonna say, except for like this last season where like.
Okay, but so I'm not completely caught up. Okay. I'm like, I think I have one season left.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, what I'll say about that show is like, what I love about it is like, it's like, I'm used to, I feel like we're kind of now conditioned for these like detective shows, whether it was like Monk or like Sherlock or something that, where it's like the lead is like on a different level of like, he's beyond fathomable in terms of how smart he is and like always the smartest person in the room kind of thing, but like otherworldly smart. Whereas like Luther is the smartest person in the room, but in a, like only by a little amount and like, in a very believable way is in like sense.
Yeah.
And it's like, I like it. It's like, it's really realistic and like grounded.
His superpower is almost that like he is morally flawed. Like he, like every other show, like Psych, Monk, all those shows, like the protagonist is like super, like they're good. They're good people who are like sharp in these very specific ways of like Monk. He's like, he has, he has OCD. And like he's very like I forget how why he's really good at his thing. I think it is because he has OCD, right?
Yeah.
And then like Sean and Psych, he is like he's just very perceptive, like almost like supernaturally perceptive.
Yeah, it's the same with Sherlock.
Yeah. Sherlock is like he has like his mind palace in the show, or in the movie. He's just like super perceptive, and Luther is just like he's smart. But he'll just get things done either way. Like he doesn't care about how he'll get something done.
Yeah, you get that feeling that it's like he's so good from experience because he's been doing this forever kind of thing. Like rather than like, oh, I see or know something that nobody could possibly know or see.
Yeah. Man, Luther is so good. I love Idris Elba. Our next question comes from Cameron Abbott on Twitter at Unsexiest Comedy. He asks, what kind of stone did the gods carve Yusef's perfect form from being before? I'm messing this up because it's such a weird question. I'm trying to recontextualize. I'm going to read it as he wrote it. What kind of stone did the gods carve his perfect form from before giving it life? Talking about Yusef.
I don't know how to answer that. Cameron, I will say Cameron is legitimately one of the nicest, kindest, most welcoming people I've ever met. I actually met him same night I met you, actually, but a little bit earlier in the night at a ramen place where I was at with Barrett, Alyssa, and I met all those guys, like Alex O'Neill, Cameron, Roger, all those guys. And yeah, again, someone I'd kind of always seen on Twitter, interacted with a little bit, and again, nicest dude in the world, had nothing but good things to say about him.
Cameron's awesome, and he wrote in the same question like multiple times, but I figured I would just pick one of them and read him on air because Cameron's also hilarious.
I don't know what I'm gonna say. Cameron's just too nice.
Jared Sku, sorry, I'm so sorry I'm pronouncing your last name. You should write in with how to pronounce your last name because it's very interesting. I also have a last name that's impossible to pronounce. And so Jared Sku asks, who would win in a fight between Ezio and Peach Rabbit? Rabbit Peach.
All right. So I was thinking about this one. And I feel like you got experience on Ezio's side. Mm-hmm. He's, you know, especially if you get in the later years, he's been around the block. He's a tactician. Rabbit Peach is just, you know, fiery. And she's got that, I wouldn't want to encounter her in a dark alleyway. You know, yeah, she's got that. So
she got a dirtiness to her. Like there's a dirtiness to her. Like she's classy, I'm sure. But man, like she's rabbit in the streets and peach in the sheets. It seems like, you know, I'm saying like, Yeah, well, I think that's the only way I can put it.
Well said. Well said. Yeah. I would. Yeah, I'm leaning more towards Rabbit Peach. Yeah.
And she's thick. Barrett Courtney on at Banana Chong on Twitter asks, "How many gophers could you self take in a fight?" I'm loving these questions, by the way.
Yeah, I know. It's an interesting set of questions. How many gophers? That's a tough question. So like all at once, right? Is that what?
Yeah. Let's go with that. Yeah.
All at once. Okay. To be fair, I feel like I don't see a whole lot of gophers. I feel like they're mostly underground, so I'm not sure. I'm imagining like something like a little bit bigger than like a hamster, like a big rat kind of thing.
Yeah, I would say like maybe like gopher, probably like maybe a tad bit bigger than like a squirrel.
Okay. I want to say somewhere around 40. I feel
maybe
like
smaller. I'm looking at a picture right now of a gopher, yeah. And they're smaller than I thought.
They're small. Okay.
Between like squirrel and mouse. Probably like around squirrel. Let's just say squirrel.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. See, they got them teeth though. So
yeah.
I'm gonna say maybe around 40. I feel like at that point they could like overwhelm me and like they'd just be clawing away at me and you know biting away. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I'm gonna go with that. I don't know how much AOE damage I could put out. So I think at a certain point they'd eventually overwhelm me.
Nice, man. My answer is
What about you?
I don't know if I could take even one. Like, I can take one. I can defend myself against ones. Once it gets to two, there's only so much I can harm an animal. Like, it's hard for me to harm a living being unless it's, like, a bug. I can kill bugs all day. But, like, man, I don't know if I could kill, like, an actual, like, breathing gopher.
I mean, that's a very good point.
Yeah.
I'm not condoning violence to animals. I'm not for that in any way.
Oh, yeah. Unless it's, like, Rabid Peach in Ezio, then it's fine. But like,
oh yeah,
oh, yeah.
But totally hypothetical. You know.
Oh yeah, it's still self defense.
Yes, so. Absolutely. I think there's a difference too, in like it's one of those things where like you know you see a rat in your house or something, and it's like kind of scary. It's like you're like it's because it's like this kind of unknown, and like you want to interact with it as little as possible. So it's like when you think about it in that sense, it's like man, like one is scary enough. But I feel like once you get to the point of like, okay, we're scrapping, we're throwing down here. Like, it's like, okay, gloves come off. Like that like fear of the unknown kind of washes away a little bit. And it's just like,
yeah, it's almost like in Tomb Raider where like Lara Croft kills like one person. And then like, it's just, she's just fine throughout the entire game where she can just kill everybody. I think that might also be me with the gophers where like, once I get through that first one, I'll just be like, you know what? Let's do this. And I might just take out some more. And so I'll say maybe three because those claws at a certain point are getting to me. Mm. Our next question comes from Ben Bellevue. He asks, how does Yusef feel about the unique power of games to allow us to explore ancestral roots such as ancient Egypt with Assassin's Creed Origins?
Wow. Good question.
Yeah.
Again, I can't really speak to necessarily like what's in the game or like the development cycle. Like that's what our dev team does, and they're awesome at it. Personally, I'm just, you know, I think we talked about this quite a bit already, but I'm just excited to get to see something that's very close and personal to me, get to see or play as someone who looks like me, right? Mm-hmm. Who's from where I'm from. And like, I'm the first person in my family not born in Egypt. I'm like, mm-hmm. I'm first generation outside of Egypt. But it's like, it's always been part of my identity, part of like who I consider myself to be. And I'm typically always the only Egyptian in places.
Mm-hmm.
That actually hasn't been true recently, which has been kind of nice, but, it's just been like, I'm so happy that it's something that exists now and something that other people can get to experience and get to be brought into games even.
Yeah, that's awesome. Like even for as far as like the historical aspect of games, like the first Assassin's Creed, like there are a lot of things that I wasn't into when it came to the first Assassin's Creed. But I think that's part of the nature of a first outing. But like the historical aspect of like walking around, where did that game take place?
So it took place in three different cities. You were in, it was Jerusalem, Damascus, and Acre.
Yes.
So it was like Damascus was like the Muslim city, Acre was like the Christian city, and Jerusalem was like the kind of both.
Yeah.
Like, hybrid city.
And like the crazy thing about me playing that game at the time I did, I played that game, I played that game late, but I played it my first year of college. When I was a freshman, and at that time I was majoring in graphic design and I was taking art history, and I remember seeing a bunch of stuff in that game that I had seen in class, like at the same time I was studying these things, and that actually like kind of helped me out in class, where I was like, oh, that's that place with like the, I can't remember what it's called, but there was like a place with like a building that was, that had like a dome that I think was like maybe like gold colored, I can't remember what it was, but like there were a lot of buildings that
it was probably the Dome of the Rock.
Yeah,
it was originally a church converted to a mosque. It's in Jerusalem.
I'm looking it up right now to see. Yep, that's exactly it. That's exactly it. I remember seeing that and climbing it and being like, yo, this is crazy that this is my textbook right now that I have to study. Yeah. And there were quite a few things like that where I was like, man, that's this thing from class. That's this. It's crazy how accurate that this game is. It's crazy how much detail they put into this game. Like, that's the thing that impressed me the most about the Assassin's Creed games, is like the accuracy they put into those things.
And even like you said, like history, like I'm a total history nerd, and like obviously I'm an architecture nerd. Mm-hmm. It was like, there was like, to me, when the first game launched, I was still in high school at the time. But I was so excited because it was going to a real place and like a part of history that doesn't often get a lot of attention, like the Crusades, like 12th century. And so like I was really excited for where it was going to go. And then when 2 and Brotherhood and Revelations came out, like those were like right up my wheelhouse of like, wow, this is Italian Renaissance. Like this is the period I'm like obsessed with. And then having played those games, gotten to know Florence through Assassin's Creed so well, you know, 2 years after that game came out, I went and I studied abroad in Florence and like was looking at all these buildings and like felt like I knew the city already because I'd played these games, and looking up at, you know, the Florence Cathedral and being like, oh, I've climbed that before. You know, I've jumped off that bell tower. Like, oh yeah. Mm-hmm. Like it's so awesome.
Yeah, for sure. Becky Mahano. Is that how I pronounce that?
Yeah. Yeah. So nice. Becky's actually my girlfriend.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, she writes in and she asks, is your strength directly tied to your beard? Is it like one of those Samson situations where if you cut it off, you can be defeated?
So she likes to tease me sometimes of saying like, oh, when we're sleeping at night, I'm going to like shave off your beard or cut a little bit of it away. And like eventually it'll be gone. Or like,
does she want it gone?
No, she loves it. Oh yeah. She just,
I was going to say, that beard is awesome.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, she likes to torment me. So legitimately, and this is probably a good thing, because I sleep pretty well at night. I don't have a whole lot of nightmares. The only nightmares I ever have anymore are of me losing my beard somehow.
That's hilarious.
Like, that is amazing. Like, making a mistake when I'm shaving and it coming, I'm like, oh, shoot, I messed that up. I need to shave the whole thing off.
Have you ever not had a beard?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I only grew this in 2014.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, that's so, like 3 years ago. So that's kind of a while.
Yeah. Well, it's at the point now where like, you know, my life's gone through various stages of like living in Boston, living in LA, now moving back here. I'm actually originally from here. And so like at this stage of my life, nobody who I know now or interacts with now on a daily basis knew me pre-beard. So it's like, it's now kind of just like a part of me. But yeah, I have no plans of getting rid of it.
Our last question comes from Ali Mushka. She asks, ask Yusuf about what got him interested in playing video games and his approach to critiquing them as art, which we kind of touched on a little bit earlier, but do you have any more to add to that?
Yeah. Like you said, I definitely hit on that a little bit of how that came about, sort of the genesis of that through grad school. But to me, that's always kind of been my favorite thing about games. As someone who was educated in art for 7 years now and now educates others about art. It was always something that felt very isolationist from the rest of the discourse. Games are, you know, kind of like comic books were, kind of like other, you know, even like movies, TV shows of, mm-hmm. oh, those don't belong with everything else. Like those are, you know, that's something for kids to play with. That's something that doesn't belong in art mm-hmm. conversations. Thankfully, the art community and people who study art are incredibly open-minded and incredibly open to sort of analyzing things as art. And to me, the whole art video games art, you know, argument is kind of silly, kind of mm-hmm. Outdated. You know, it's, I'll say this. This is going to be a big tangent. Sorry. So there's this work of art called Fountain by a man named Marcel Duchamp. You can look it up right now. Maybe, I don't know if you do this, like insert a picture. It's literally just a urinal that's laid on its side. Mm. And the whole idea behind it was that Marcel Duchamp was trying to bring up this question of what is art, and who has the authority to say what is and what isn't art. And there's this old, I think if you go and you ask 10 different people what art is, you'll get 10 different answers. And if you were to get one sort of unified answer, a repeated answer, I think it would be, I don't know, but I know it when I see it. Mm. And that was something that one of my professors in grad school hated. And she would actually sort of flip that term. She said, it's not you know it when you see it, it's you see art when you know it. So mm. it's having that understanding, that definition, that knowledge of what art can do, what it can achieve, what it's capable of, and then being able to recognize it in things. Mm. And so, like I said, at no point have I ever tried to justify games as art, but I've always just looked at them through that lens of, you know, art needs to say something. It needs to convey a message. The worst thing you can say about a work of art is, it's just kind of whatever, right? Mm-hmm. Ambivalence to something is the worst reaction. And whether you love something or you absolutely hate it, as art, it is doing its job either way. So if you hate that urinal, which a lot of people do and did, and I used to even at some point, it's working. It's saying something to you that's getting a reaction out of you. And to me, art has always done that, right? Whether it's painting, whether it's photography, sculpture, or anything like that. And certain games have done that to me. Certainly not all games, and certainly not all paintings, but certain games have always done that to me. And my sort of obsession with them, and I think similarly with architecture, is that interactive portion of it, that agency that you have in it, that the way that it's working on you, the way that it does something on you. Whereas, you know, that's always kind of been what fascinated me about architecture, is not necessarily, oh, that looks cool, that looks neat, is okay, someone arranged this room, these walls, this hallway, these doors this way to make me behave in a certain way. And how am I going to behave because of what someone else did? And video games are that almost to an even higher degree, because they oftentimes limit where you can go and where you can't. And so why am I doing the things I'm doing? It's because this was designed this way. And that's a lot of where I sort of draw my comparisons between the two. I can give you an easy example of that too. That might have been a little bit difficult to follow, but if you talk about hallways, so hallways did not always exist in architecture. They essentially, you used to have, if you look at, you know, ancient Roman villas, you look at even houses in the, you know, 15th century, you just sort of have rooms. You have one room that's connected to another room, that's connected to another room, that's connected to another room. Meaning that if you're in the entry, you're at the beginning of a house, and you want to get to the back of it, you're going to need to walk through two or three rooms to get there. And there's going to be maybe people in those rooms, and they're going to be doing things in those rooms, and you're going to have to go through them to get there. A room is not necessarily a destination. It can also be a thoroughfare in that sense. Then you have the introduction of the hallway, which comes about in the 17th century. And suddenly you have a space that's designated for circulation, a place that you're designed and intended to simply just move through to get from one place to another. And if you think about that, what happens then is you get rooms with only one door. And so what I mean, so if you go back to a home that has no hallways, where rooms can be thoroughfares, where rooms can be passageways, you need multiple entries and exits, right? If I'm going to go from the entryway through the kitchen to a family room to a bedroom or something like that, each of those needs to have a doorway to let me hop through. But then when you have the hallway, you just have a door, you enter, that's the same door you exit from, because that room becomes a destination suddenly. It's not a means to an end to go somewhere else. And then if you think about, I don't know if you ever get this feeling like when I play like the Fallout games or like an Elder Scrolls game or something like that, I get a little bit of almost anxiety of, I need to make sure I saw everything. I need to make sure I found everything. I need to make sure I explored every room. Mm-hmm. And you're walking down a hallway and you have rooms that are sectioned off, and it's okay. I'm in a hallway. I turn in this corner into this room. There's only one entry into this room. So I know if I search everything in this room, I'm done. I can cross it off the list. I can then go on to the next thing. Whereas something like certain games, like Gone Home, for example, which I actually talked about a lot in my thesis, have rooms that are thoroughfares too. And so it's, okay, I can explore everything in here, but I'm going to go through again and come back, and maybe it changes next time I'm in here. Maybe it shifts. And so the introduction of the hallway is something that changes architecture, because it's now making sure that if you're in a room, you intended to be there. You're not just passing through. And it gives a space for people to move without disturbing others. And video games use this, obviously, to encourage movement, because it's something we're socially conditioned to do. When we're in a hallway of, okay, I need to move to another spot. I need to get to another spot. I need to move down this hallway. And it's giving you that option, that choice, through something that we're ingrained in knowing architecturally.
That's super interesting. I think even like that kind of reminds me of like PT, of like the whole game kind of being a hallway that's kind of designed to like keep us moving through. And even like PT is a game that stops you in your tracks a few times because it wants you to stop and wants you to look around, and that kind of feels uncomfortable in that game because kind of like for that reason that you mentioned, that like hallways are kind of designed to kind of like to kind of guide you in that way. I mean, that's a really cool way of looking at things. I really like that. That's pretty dope.
PT is an even better example.
Yeah.
I don't play that I didn't play that just because I'm a baby and I can't play scary games. But I've heard nothing but amazing things. And like that, the idea of it being in a hallway, like I need to play that at some point, because I'm sure there's tons.
I think you'd be fascinated by it, honestly. Yeah. Like, I mean, it is a scary game. Like, it is like there's some creepy things going on, and I guess you can't really download it anymore unless you do some trickery. But like, you should find a way to play it if you can. And if you like, just play with some homies in the daytime with like a bodyguard or something.
Yeah, lights on.
Awesome, man. Well, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast. I really appreciate it.
No, thank you, man. I thanks for having me on. I really appreciate this. Like I said, my first podcast, so hopefully I wasn't too awkward or bad.
Oh, no, dude, you did a great job for your first time, especially. You killed it, for sure. If people want to find you on the internet, where can they find you?
You can follow me on Twitter. My handle is just my name, Yusef Magid. It's a bit difficult to spell. It's Y-O-U. S-S-E-F and then M-A-G-U-I-D, all one word. Nice thing about having a unique name is you get that handle for everything. So yeah, Instagram also.
Dude, I've been trying to get Blessing Jr. for everything, and it's like just unique enough where I'm getting stuff, but then like there's always that one thing that I can't get, and for me it's like it's Xbox Live. I got an Xbox for the first time last year, and I tried to get it. I was like, certainly, like I can get it on Instagram, Twitter, Snapchat, everything. And I don't have it on PSN because I made PSN forever ago. But I wanted to change it to it. And I tried to get it on Xbox Live, and it was like unavailable. And I was like, are you serious? And so that, it always hurts when you can't. But yeah, man, shout out to your name.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's always helping out. For those listening, remember that the OK Beast podcast is a weekly gaming and nerd culture centric show. This is where we get together and talk about the biggest topics in games and culture. If you like the show, subscribe to us on your streaming service choice. Visit OKBeast.com and follow at OK Beast Now on Twitter and Instagram. I've been Blessing. You can find me at Blessing Jr. on Twitter. That's been Yusef. We will see you. Well, me and Ian will see you possibly in, probably me and another guest, actually. We'll see you on the next episode. Peace.